You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 313, Exodus Q&A Part 2. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike. How you doing?
Well, pretty good. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. Yeah. The flu is actually...
It's cold here.
Yeah. Well, the flu is kind of going around here. So everybody's been hit with the flu. I'm over it. So if I had it, I don't know what if I had it or not, but it kind of had a fever for a day or two, but I'm good now.
Well, I haven't had to deal with any of that. You know, it's just, I keep getting blamed for the weather here though. Yeah, last night teaching again. Did you bring the weather? Because it was like 55 degrees and raining. And it's like, well, it sure looks familiar, but no.
Yeah, and how's the theology school going?
Good. You know, we're 2 weeks in now to the live class. You know, people are enjoying it, and I'm able to keep up with that. We're gonna get hit on Monday. That's when the distance ed class opens up. We've got like 120, 130 live people, you know, spread out over two nights. And then there's another 600, you know, by distance. So that's going to challenge us logistically. So we're just sort of waiting for it to happen. And that kind of means that this week is the first sort of real week as far as, you know, what the workload's going to be like and, you know, how the week goes. So we're about ready to find out. So next week I'll have an updated either report or lament. I don't know. You know, just to sort of wait and see, you know, how things go, you know, how we keep up with everything.
Yeah. And I saw you posted some pictures about your new book that's out.
The Enoch book. Yeah. You know, again, it's still on Amazon, like at shipping in March, you know, but they released it early. So yeah, if people go up and order it, it's a reader's commentary on the Book of Enoch, volume one, which is the first 36 chapters of the Book of Enoch, also known as, you know, the first 36 chapters are known as the Book of the Watchers. So yeah, people could order it now and get it, you know. And for those who might not be familiar with what a reader's commentary is, this is not a verse by verse, look at every word, you know, kind of commentary, because that'd be like 1,000 pages, you know, for these 36, you know, chapters. It's just me kind of like, hey, if I were sitting there with you while you were reading the Book of Enoch, you know, commenting on things that would help you understand what in the world the book is saying, you know, what it's about, what's going on. So there's nothing like it in print, which is kind of surprising. You either get zero or you get these high end, there does exist a high end, really, really detailed two volume work on the Book of Enoch. And then even the old version by R.H. Charles, done at the turn of the 20th century. I mean, that still exists in public domain, but it presupposes people can read Greek and Hebrew and Aramaic characters. So we're trying to fill a gap here, just something far less dense that is reader-friendly and helpful. So yeah, if you're interested in Enoch, by all means, please get the book.
Well, Mike, this is our second Q&A on Exodus, and we lied. We said we were only going to have two, but we're going to stretch this out to three Q&As because we just can't get enough of Exodus. We don't want to quite
go
just yet, but we are going to have three parts. And, you know, we did have to whittle these questions down, so we appreciate everybody that sent in the questions and apologize to the ones that we couldn't get to. But, Mike, we've got a lot of questions here, so how about we just jump into it and try to...
Yeah, we should. Some of these are actually pretty involved. I mean, we are trying to whittle out thesis questions, and you're going to wonder, well, boy, that one that you did today was pretty long. It is, but it's still not a thesis question. So we're trying, but yeah, there are some in this episode, having looked at the questions, that are going to be pretty involved.
Okay. Well, our first question is going to be from Susan, and she has a question about the verbs hazak and kashah. Mm-hmm. And she wants to know, she was wondering if you could address these two verbs used, what's the difference, and why these two verbs, specifically in Exodus 7?
Yeah, I mean, usually you have I'll try to summarize it this way. I mean, these are both verbs that are used in the hardening passages, you know, where Pharaoh or God, you know, hardens Pharaoh's heart. And, you know, typically you've got chazak used to describe that. But occasionally you get this other verb, kasha. And so, you know, the question is essentially, you know, why, what's the difference here? You know, why not just use one verb? You know, there's really no meaningful difference. It's sort of nuancing the same idea. Like chazak is a term that refers to either physical hardness. You know, it would be used in context where it's talking about something that is physically, you know, hard, or something that's really like strong, you know, unable to be broken or torn, that sort of thing. And by extension, then metaphorically, it speaks to sort of like a determined, solidified resistance. Kasha, on the other hand, often speaks to severity or difficulty of something. It's the word, for instance, behind the English phrase that you see in English translations, stiff-necked. Like, you know, you're a stiff-necked people. Literally, it's you're difficult of neck or difficult of the back of the neck. So it's an idiomatic expression for just being really stubborn, being difficult. And so metaphorically, again, that option, kasha, is an abstraction of a physical posture or, you know, an expressive posture that connotes stubbornness or resistance. So both lemmas essentially make the same point. It's just a slightly different nuancing between them.
Our next question is from Mike, and he never knew chronology and geography could contain so many issues. In the chronology and geography yeah. in the same sentence, impossible, truly really? Baffling, he says. But his question is, where is 3 days into the wilderness to sacrifice unto the Lord? And he's got a couple of points here with that. Sinai is not the place. Mm-hmm. They arrived here on the third moon after leaving Egypt in Exodus 19:1, mm-hmm. and Marah is the place on the way to sacrifice to the Lord, Exodus 15:22 and Numbers 33:8. Both put them at Marah 3 days after entering the wilderness.
Yeah, these examples actually show us how complicated this is. It doesn't uncomplicate anything. So on the one hand, Exodus 19, you know, again, I'll just read it. On the third new moon after the people of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on that day, they came into the wilderness of Sinai. Okay. Well, three new moons, again, that would be like 3 months, which is a reasonable chronology. And so if that was it, you could just say, oh, okay, we got a 3 month chronology here. That's easy. However, Marah, of course, refers to 3 days after entering the wilderness. So what do we have here? Is there an overlap between Marah and the wilderness of Sinai, or I mean, you have this 3 days afterward, because the sacrifice, the only sacrifice that you're going to see occurs at Sinai with the covenant. So now you've got a location of the wilderness of Sinai broadly. You've got Marah, and now, and when you get to Exodus 24, it's at the mountain Sinai. So what are we supposed to do with that? Again, if you ask yourself, where does the sacrifice occur, and are there any other sacrifices? The answer is at Mount Sinai. And you say, well, why is that important? It's important because when they're standing before Pharaoh, and it isn't just that scene, it's other scenes. You know, Moses is, you know, the demand is let the people go. You know, Yahweh wants you to let his people go so that they can, you know, offer sacrifice 3 days, you know, go 3 days and offer a sacrifice. And you have this reference. I'll just read some. You know, what God tells him at the burning bush, they will listen to your voice. He's speaking to Moses. You and the elders of Israel shall go to the king of Egypt and say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. And now please let us go 3 days journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. Exodus 5:3, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Let us go 3 days journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. You know, 8:27, 15:22. I mean, these are phrases that connect going into the wilderness 3 days with a sacrifice. And the only sacrifice that you get in the story is at Mount Sinai. So let's just take those verses and compare them to Exodus 19, which again is a very, very obvious reference to 3 months. How do you put those things together? Why wouldn't Moses say before Pharaoh, hey, let us go to God's mountain. I mean, not even give a chronology so that we can offer sacrifice. Or let us go 3 months into the wilderness or something like that, and then we can offer sacrifice. The statements aren't the same. I mean, they're not, and the difficulty is, how do you come up with something that is congruent? And you have the added issue of, okay, are we headed into the wilderness, like we're still moving toward it? Or did we go, you know, should we translate some of these verses as they went through the wilderness, like on the way to Sinai? You know, that's actually workable. You know, I mean, or I shouldn't say workable. That's actually a possibility. It's a legitimate translation to take these references to going 3 days into the wilderness as going 3 days through the wilderness. I don't even know if it helps, though. It's the same preposition in all of the occurrences where the 3 days are connected with the bet. Okay, that's the preposition in Hebrew, and then the word for wilderness. It's always the preposition bet. It can mean through rather than into or to, you know, like a directional kind of thing. So these are the data that you essentially have to play with. So sure, you know, Exodus 19:1, that's 3 months, that's clear. But how does that work with all the other ones? It's up to the interpreter to sort of figure this out. And it definitely is part of the whole discussion of, okay, where are we going to locate Sinai? Depending on how you answer the question, you know, of where are we going? Are we going to it or through it? What are the, does the 3 days, should we isolate the 3 days to just the wilderness? And you might say, well, that's a convenient way to handle the whole thing. Well, again, the problem is the sacrifice is at Mount Sinai. That's about the only sure thing we have. Okay, that's where the sacrifice is, and there isn't another sacrifice. And so you can make that argument, but then that still leaves the question on the table. Why wasn't Moses and Aaron's wording different when it came to their conversation with Pharaoh? Because it's quite incomplete. You know, that's what you're left with. You know, and you can argue, well, that was intentional. He doesn't need to know. Or, you know, I mean, you can speculate on how this might work. And that's what commentators do. You know, they speculate on how to put all these things together. So there is no quick fix, you know, to this sort of thing. And it's not solved by just appealing to Exodus 19:1. Exodus 19:1, I think, again, makes the issue more pronounced. But, you know, it's there, you know, so it's part of the data and we have to think about it.
Arnold has our next question and he's trying to get his head around Exodus 7. It says, "See, I have made you like a god to Pharaoh." I'm wondering, did Pharaoh consider Moses as a usurper to his kingdom because he had been part of the royal family? Pharaoh represented his god and Moses represented Yahweh. Kind of a battle of the gods, with the demonstration of the plagues being the demonstrations of the demons or fallen angels, gods. Am I reading mm-hmm. too much into this?
Well, I would say, based upon how the story plays out, the answer would be yeah. You know, if it was before Moses leaves Egypt, you know, the Pharaoh very well could have, you know, seen him as a usurper. In other words, if you take the whole story and you take out the fact that Moses killed an Egyptian and has to run away and he's in exile, and then God tells him that you're going to go be my deliverer and you're going to bring the people out of here and you're going to bring them back here. If you took that element out, if you just had Moses in Egypt and then somehow Moses does these miraculous things, you know, to punish the Egyptian gods, well, then, yeah, that's like a usurper confrontation. But those other things are there. Basically, Moses is demanding, because this is what God tells him to say, he's demanding to leave Egypt. He doesn't want to stay, so he can't really be viewed as a usurper. What kind of usurper would say, I'm going to take over your kingdom, but I'm never going to be here. Let me out of here. So it doesn't work on that level. But again, if, you know, I'll grant the idea anyway, if, you know, absent of these details of the story. But there's no indication that Moses wants to stick around and rule, which is how I would parse a term like usurper. Going, you know, a related direction, just, you know, dealing with the term itself, I think the statement is relatively straightforward about being an Elohim, being like a god, you know, to Pharaoh. the signs and wonders that occur at the hand of Moses. You know, when we know God is doing this through him, but from Pharaoh's perspective, you know, these are things that a God does. This is the power of deity. And since Moses is the agent, he's the conduit for these things, he's naturally going to perceive Moses as having godlike power. So, you know, Moses, of course, in the story is going to relate what's happening to the power of Yahweh. I mean, he's not going to claim to be the source of the power. But from Pharaoh's perspective, that's the way it would look. You know, this is the power of a God that Pharaoh had refused to acknowledge. I do take the plagues as a contest between Yahweh and the gods of Egypt, and we spent a good deal of time on that idea in several episodes of the podcast that cover the plagues. So I think that's kind of obvious, especially when you sort of drill down and you know, try to think like an Egyptian here as far as what's happening to you. How does this affect not only your day-to-day life, but when you factor in what they're thinking about the gods, how the gods are supposed to maintain their everyday life, especially Pharaoh being the incarnation of Horus. Well, it's hard to read it not as an attack on Egyptian theology, you know, the various gods in the pantheon. But as far as usurper, again, when I see that term, I think somebody who wants to stick around and rule in the place of the one who is king at the time. And that really just isn't part of the story.
Kimberly has a question about the difference between the Book of the Covenant and the two tablets of stone. Why do you suppose God wrote with his finger on the tablets when Moses had already written the book? As well as, how many times did Moses go up into the mount to meet the Lord? One time he comes down to warn the people to stay back beyond the boundary. Another, he comes down when the people are in heinous apostasy. And another, he comes down and builds 12 pillars and an altar. Am I reading this right?
Well, yeah, it's really hard to track the coming and going. And we actually alluded to this in a couple of episodes because, you know, for not only for the reasons that Kimberly just mentioned, where, you know, you have to read the story and think, okay, you know, is he coming like all the way down or part of the way down? Or is like he shouting down, you know, like to do these things? You have to sort of reconstruct the events in your imagination. And again, commentators, you know, have to do the same thing. So there's, I mean, that's just part of the enterprise. So we're not really told explicitly, is he still on the mountain when he does this or that, or is he moving around, or are these clean cut up and down, you know, movements? That's one issue. The other issue is, when you get these episodes, you have interspersed, before the episodes really even end discreetly, you have other material sort of thrown in there. And it really makes the chronology quite difficult to follow. You know, so you have this confusing, intrusive nature, you know, of some of the material, and it's not something that can really be avoided. It just, the text is what it is. So, you know, we hit on this a little bit in earlier episodes, but to narrow the focus, if you're, I'm not saying this necessarily helps, it might even be cheating a little bit, but if you narrow the focus and ask, okay, how many times did he go up and back to receive the law? I mean, let's telescope it a little bit. Well, there's two of those. And the other sort of comings and goings, again, you have to sort of, in your mind's eye, imagine, you know, what's going on in the scene, and we lack some information to know if he comes all the way down or if he moves around different parts and all this kind of stuff. So if you're talking about receiving the tablets of the law, those are two episodes. There's one before the golden calf debacle and one after. That's kind of a neat way to divide them, even though you have this intrusive material in there. But that much, I think, is discernible. But whether that's the whole picture or not is the question. So due to the ordering of the material prior to the golden calf, Moses' comings and goings can sound pretty confusing. Another idea, and some commentators actually do this, if we take out all the intrusive sections, then what does it read like? I mean, to sort of answer this question. If you do that, then that helps a little bit. I think it does. But, you know, we're not saying take out the material and throw it away. It's just, you know, take it out, see what it reads like in narrative form, and that might help, you know, clarify things. So that would be my suggestion as far as, you know, just take a whack at it and see if that doesn't make anything, you know, clearer. As far as the finger of God, you know, sort of language, Exodus 24:12 interestingly enough. Let's just read a couple of these. Exodus 24:12 reads as follows. The Lord said to Moses, "Come up to me on the mountain and wait there, that I may give you the tablets of stone with the law and the commandment which I have written for their instruction." Now, you notice it says, "which I have written." God says God takes credit for writing these. There's no phrase that says finger of God in that verse, but you do have verses that talk about God essentially producing the written content and then giving it to Moses. So not only do you have finger of God language, and that would be Exodus 31:18 is where that phrase is actually found. He gave to Moses, when he had finished speaking with him on Mount Sinai, the two tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone written with the finger of God. Then you have a third reference, Exodus 32:16. The tablets were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets. Okay, well, does that mean it doesn't quite sound like Exodus 24:12, which really does sound like God's doing the writing? The writing of God might be, you know, God was its ultimate point of origin. Could have been a dictation or something else. Okay, but you still have that verse that you could read as though God is the one, you know, actually producing the written content. So there's three of these in Exodus. When you go to Deuteronomy, again, you also get the idea. Remember, Deuteronomy, you're going to have a lot of these, you're going to have a lot of repetition from Exodus. So Deuteronomy 9:10, the Lord gave me the two tablets of stone written with the finger of God. And on them were all the words that the Lord had spoken with you on the mountain out of the midst of the fire the day of assembly. Deuteronomy 10:4 is a related passage again. So we've got two of these in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 10:4 says, "And he wrote on the tablets in the same writing as before, the Ten Commandments that the Lord had spoken to you on the mountain out of the midst of the fire on the day of assembly, and the Lord gave them to me." So who's the he? If you back up, at that time the Lord said to me, "Cut for yourself two tablets, come up on the mountain, make an ark of wood, and then I will write on the tablets the words that were on the first tablets that you broke." So the he, in a few verses later in Deuteronomy 10:4, is apparently God there. Again, we don't have the finger of God statement, but we have this idea of God writing. So those are five passages. In two of them, you have the phrase finger of God, and the other ones can be read as though God's producing this stuff. Now, what do we do with that? Now, Jewish and Christian commentators disagree over the anthropomorphic language. You know, and it's, if God's the one writing, then he has to have fingers, he has to have a hand, he has to be embodied, you know, that kind of thing. So they disagree over how to handle the anthropomorphic language here, either literally or some other way. Now, I think, and people who have read Unseen Realm, I think that Yahweh as a man was at Sinai giving Moses the law. And I talk a little bit about that in Unseen Realm in relation to Paul's comment about an intermediary on Mount Sinai. In Galatians 3:19. Let me just read that. It's on page 166 of Unseen Realm that I get into this, but Paul asks, "Why then the law? It was added because of transgressions, until the offspring should come to whom the promise had been made. And it was put in place, the law was put in place, through angels by means of an intermediary." Now, an intermediary implies more than one, but God is one. So in Unseen Realm, I talk about why would Paul be concerned to qualify what's going on at Sinai? Why does he have to say, here's what happened at Sinai? There was this intermediary figure, okay? And I talk about how Jewish commentators will say the intermediary is Moses. Well, that doesn't make any sense. If it's Moses, why is Paul concerned to qualify his statement that, lest you get freaked out, I still believe that God is one. If we have a second Yahweh figure there, that makes more sense, that Paul has to say, look, God is still one. So because of Paul's language there, I do think that the embodied, or maybe not embodied, or at least it would have to be embodied if he's writing, but at the very least, an anthropomorphic Yahweh figure, like we've seen in so many other places in the Torah. I think that he's present at Sinai giving the law. And so when I look at finger of God statements and some of these other statements about God producing the content, I take them at face value because I do think we have God as a man on Sinai dispensing the law. And again, I'm that's just, it's not my, I'm not the only one who thinks that. I mean, there are other people who take the anthropomorphism there similarly, but there are plenty of other people who don't, that just say it's, you know, there's nothing like that going on. So those who don't either, they either don't consider this idea or they're uncomfortable with it, would prefer to point to other references to God's fingers in verses that talk about creation, like Psalm 8:4. And just to be fair to the other side, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you care for him? Okay, so we've got this psalm. You made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honor. You have given him dominion over the work of your hands, so on and so forth. Okay, there's a reference to hands there, but if you go back to verse 3, when I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and stars, so on and so forth, they would say, well, did, you know, was there an embodied God there doing creation with the stars? I mean, there's a reference to God's fingers. It's obviously figurative. Okay, I get that. I get that. That doesn't really help me deal with Paul's language. And it certainly doesn't erase the number of places in the Torah where Yahweh does come as a man. So I find that trajectory unsatisfying for those reasons. But anyway, that's how I kind of look at it. I think that it's there to bring out this second Yahweh in human form idea. That's why I think the finger of God language is there.
John thinks you have presented some good arguments on both sides of the early late debate for the Exodus. However, there is something that is confusing to me in regards to the late date. If we know from Egyptology where Ramesses II is buried, and when he died, doesn't that cancel him out of the picture for the Exodus, since by the biblical account, the Pharaoh of the Exodus was swept away in the Red Sea? Also, how does the lifespan of Ramesses II, 1303 BC to 1213 BC, account for the Merneptah Stela from the 1208 BC, which lists Israel in line 27 as an already established nation?
Yeah, there's two parts to this. On the first part about the Pharaoh of the Exodus being swept away in the Red Sea, we talked about this language earlier in the podcast on the episodes that, you know, dealt with the crossing. Late daters, of course, are going to dispute that language. Let me just read it. This is Psalm 136:15. Let me get a little bit of the context here. Let's see. To him who struck down the firstborn of Egypt, for his steadfast love endures forever, and brought Israel out from among them, for his steadfast love endures forever. With a strong hand and an outstretched arm, for his steadfast love endures forever. To him who divided the Red Sea in two, for his steadfast love endures forever, and made Israel pass through the midst of it, for his steadfast love endures forever, but overthrew Pharaoh and his host in the Red Sea, for his steadfast love endures forever. Now, there's the verse reference right there. And so late daters are going to say, well, you know, there's no reason that we have to take that terminology and think that Pharaoh was killed. It's not any of the normal Hebrew words for killed or destroyed or anything like that. It means overthrew or shake off or something like that. So they're going to dispute the wording. They're also going to go to Exodus 14, the actual account of the crossing, and say, well, you know, it has Pharaoh and all of Pharaoh's horsemen and his chariots are the ones that actually go into the sea. It never actually says that Pharaoh went in. And so they would argue that Psalm 136:15 should not be read as though Pharaoh did go into the sea. You're assuming that he went into the sea because of the overthrow language, but again, it's not the language for killing or destruction. So they're just going to dispute the whole thing and say that the verse is inconclusive. When it comes to the second part of the question, the Merneptah Stela or the Merneptah Stela, you'll see it spelled both ways, the Pharaoh's name spelled both ways. This is actually a famous late date argument. So I'm going to read a little excerpt here from Dictionary of the Old Testament, Pentateuch volume. This is Walton wrote this on the date of the Exodus, and he specifically discusses the Merneptah Stela. and something that's related. So I'll just read this. He writes, "This victory poem contains the earliest extra-biblical reference to Israel." That may not be true anymore, but we'll just go with it. "It has been quite controversial. Uncontested is that it is to be dated in Merneptah's fifth year, toward the end of the 13th century." That's the early 1200s or the 1200 whatever. "The significant line," Walton says, reads, "Israel is laid waste, its seed is not." The context refers to four entities in the land of Canaan, or Karu in Egyptian. Three of them, Ashkelon, Gezer, and Yanoam, are marked by the determinative that indicates they were city-states. Now, let me just stop there. Egyptian, in many of its words, they will put a hieroglyph. I mean, they're all hieroglyphs, obviously, but they'll put a hieroglyph at the end of a word to classify it. The scholars call this a determinative. It's not something that gets translated verbally or even transliterated. It's a cheat. It's like a visual cheat. It just allows you to classify, you know, a category for the word. And what he's saying here is three of the four entities named in this stela get the determinative that indicates they were city-states. Israel, in contrast, is marked by the determinative that indicates it was a socio-religious group. In other words, not a city-state. You know, they're not really established, you know, like in towns and cities, okay? Otherwise, they would get the other determinative. Walton continues, "This marks a largely immovable endpoint for discussion." That's a nice statement there about the Exodus. "Not only was Israel in the land by 1207, but it is likely they had not just gotten there, and more likely that the initial campaigns of the conquest had been completed and the transition had been made into the Judges period. Even if we allow only 5 years for the initial stages of the conquest and then add a generation in the wilderness, this inscription would push the latest possible date of the Exodus at least back to 1240 or 1250 or midway through Ramses II. So that gives you a little bit of Walton's disposition toward this. But again, a late dater is going to look at this and say, look, the reason it's marked this way, even if they had been there 5 or 30 or 40 years, is the conditions of a settled national entity to the writer of this stela were not present. So you have that issue. And both early and late daters are going to argue, again, they're going to have to, just like with the visits up and down Sinai, you're going to have to sort of visualize, you know, what this means, the presence or the absence of this particular determinative, city-state or not, in Israel's case, something that's not a city-state, just a people group. Now, Walton goes on and he mentions some work done with inscriptions at Karnak. In 1978, F. Yurko, this is Frank Yurko, deduced that reliefs on the western face of the enclosure wall of the corps de cachet at Karnak belonged to Merneptah rather than Ramses II, as previously thought. The relief pictures the siege of three fortified cities and the conquest of a fourth entity not connected to a fortified city. Only one of the cities is identified, Ashkelon, one of the four enemies listed on the Merneptah stela. Consequently, Yurko surmised that the two other besieged cities pictured on the wall but not named could be Gezer and Yanoam, also listed on the Merneptah stela. If this correlation between the wall and the stela holds, the fourth scene on the wall could well represent the Israelites. A.F. Rainey, Anson Rainey, rejects this last identification because Egypt's enemy in scene 4 has chariots, which Rainey considers unlikely for Israel in this period. He suggests that Israel should be associated with the Shasu pastoralists who were being brought as prisoners in the wall reliefs, rather than with the enemy of scene 4. Most have accepted Yurko's identification, which only reinforces the conclusions drawn from the Merneptah stela. Now let me try to summarize this. What you have with the Merneptah stela, imagine if the Exodus had occurred in 1446 BC, well, that's over 200 years before Merneptah. And it's also well after the conquest. You're well into the Judges period, and they're now occupying cities, you know, that they inherit after the conquest. So the Merneptah stela wouldn't make, you know, much sense at all. Or again, you could reimagine, oh, maybe they were driven out of these cities. Blah. Maybe he's just in a district that, you know, they're running around and, you know, you use your imagination. But it just wouldn't make any sense. Now, however, if the Exodus had occurred in the time of Ramses, you know, 30, 40 years prior to Merneptah, and they're not yet into the land and occupying these cities. And you say, well, how does that work with the conquest? What would the Egyptians be doing there? I mean, how can the Egyptians take credit, you know, for laying Israel waste when the conquest is going? I get it. I get it. There are problems there too. But the issue is not seeing Israel as an established city state makes more sense with a late date Exodus than not. I think you can already see that either view has problems, and proponents of either view are going to have their way of reconstructing in the imagination of their audience how this would work. You know, to either get rid of the Merneptah stela as being relevant or to make it a, sort of a pillar of the argument. It's just the way it goes. It's like everything else when it comes to the date of the Exodus. You're going to have ways of defending a data point, and you're going to have ways of undermining it. So nothing changes here, really, in terms of the outcome.
All right, our next question, a few people were tracking on the same thing. Roland and Diane in Valley Center, California, and then also Nick wanted some insight over the connection between Exodus 3 and John 8:58. And Roland and Diane's question is, do you understand that the Jews understood Jesus was declaring that he was the eternal God incarnate, and that he equated himself with the I am statement in Exodus 3:14. There are many I am statements in the book of John, such as I am the bread of life in John 6:35, 41, 48, 51, and I am the light of the world in John 8:12. By making these statements, do you believe that Jesus is saying that he is the I am of Exodus 3:14?
Well, the way I would answer this is, first of all, I think theologically, yes, there's plenty in John that identifies and thus equates Jesus with God, okay, with the God of the burning bush. I say it that way because it is not at all clear that the I am statements go back to Exodus 3:14. Now, you might be wondering, well, how in the world is that? Because in Exodus 3:14, you know, God says, I am who I am, or I am that I am, okay? And then you ego a me in John, it occurs in a number of passages. It is translated I am. So it's assumed that when you see it in John, that the reference is the burning bush incident. But there's actually another good candidate, and some would argue even a better candidate. The theology produced in either direction is the same. You know, it's Jesus is identifying himself with Yahweh or being identified with Yahweh. But since this is kind of a, I don't want to say sort of a popular topic, but it's something that you might hear in church, I thought we would drill down on this a little bit. I think, again, let's just approach it this way. The I am statements, whatever their point of reference, let's just set that aside for the moment. The I am statements in John certainly create a connection between Jesus and the Father. The only question is, what do those statements derive from? So you have, you know, two issues. There's the statement, the I am, and then where it comes from. Now, having already affirmed that, yeah, you know, these I am statements, at least some of them, do equate Jesus with God, with the Father, I want to get into the weeds here a little bit, because I don't think all of them do. And the issue here is grammar. Now, for those of you who you might have this in Logos, you might have it in hard copy, but I want to read some extended parts of Father Raymond Brown's commentary on John. It's a two-volume, massive commentary on John. It's actually a famous commentary. It's in the Anchor Bible series. Father Brown is the same guy who wrote like a 1,500-page book on the birth of the Messiah and another 1,500-page book on the death of the Messiah. I mean, it's just really good stuff. It's incredibly detailed. So these are kind of go-to resources for the Gospel of John and really the life of Christ. And you can imagine You know, Father Brown was a famous Catholic scholar, so this is like, this is really important to them. Okay. So all of these things, this is an incredibly detailed treatment. He has an appendix in his commentary on Ego Eimi, I Am. He has a whole appendix on it, and it's long, but I'm going to read you parts of it just so that you can start to see why I would answer the way I do. So I think, yes, some of these really do create a link between Jesus and God the Father. That's does it or does it not create this theology? My answer to that is yes, but not all of them do. And then the second question, which we'll get to, is what's the Old Testament reference point? So Father Brown writes this: the Greek ego eimi, I am, can be simply a phrase of common speech equivalent to it is I, or I am the one. However, it also has a solemn and sacral use in the Old Testament, the New Testament, Gnosticism, and even pagan Greek religious writings. Bultmann, he's going to quote Bultmann here, Rudolf Bultmann, has classified four different uses of the formula. I think these are actually handy for, you know, how we would sort of interpret the language. So A, I'm going to give you all four. A, an introduction, which answers the question, who are you? Thus, Father Brown, his example is, I am Socrates, or in Genesis 17:1, I am El Shaddai. So the first way ego eimi in Greek can be used is just to answer the question, who are you? B, it can also be used as a description of the subject, answering the question, what are you? So now catch that. Ego eimi can answer the question, who are you? It can also answer the question, what are you? Father Brown's example is thus, I am a philosopher. Or in Ezekiel 28, the king of Tyre says, I am a god. All right. Third, it can also be used where the speaker identifies himself with another person or thing. Bultmann cites a saying of Isis, I am all that has been, that is, and that will be. The predicate sums up the identity of the subject. Okay, so that's the third way to look at it. Fourth is, it could be a formula that separates the subject from other subjects. It answers the question, who is the one who, you know, fill in the blank, with the response, that's me, it is I. This is an instance in which the I is really a predicate. Now, keeping in mind, Brown continues, the spectrum of usage extending from the banal to the sacral, let us consider the use of ego eimi in John. Grammatically, we may distinguish three types of use. Okay, and I'm going to give you all three here. So Brown says, first is what he calls the absolute use with no predicate. Now, you need to know a little grammar here. Ego eimi is a personal pronoun and a verb. I am. Okay, literally, it's I am. You could translate it, I myself am, you know, just to convey the idea that you have a pronoun, first person pronoun, and then a verb form of the to be verb that is first person singular. You have them coupled together, but there's no predicate. Remember, from grammar, you have a subject and a predicate. The verb am is not an action verb. It's not what grammarians call a feintive verb. It's a state of being verb. And so, you know, it doesn't offer you any predication. Predication is a way of commenting on the subject. So I am a teacher. Okay, a teacher would be the predicate because it's a way to comment on the subject, which is I. Am just sort of links the two, all right? So Brown is saying, look, sometimes ego eimi occurs with no predicate. There's nothing added to it that would describe the subject in any way. It's just not there. So the absolute use occurs a few times in John. John 8:24, unless you come to believe that I am, you will surely die in your sins. John 8:28, when you lift up the Son of Man, then you shall realize that I am. You know, it's just there by itself is the point. John 8:58, before Abraham even came into existence, I am. John 13:19. When it does happen, you may believe that I am. Now, Brown writes, there's a natural tendency to feel that these statements are incomplete. For instance, in John 8:25, the Jews respond by saying, well, then who are you? You know, Jesus says, unless you come to believe that I am, you will surely die in your sins. So the Jews are thinking, well, he didn't complete the sentence. You know, that's your what? Unless you come to believe that I'm what? I mean, finish the sentence. So they actually ask him, well, who are you? You know, it felt incomplete to them. Brown says, you know, you have these instances, since this usage goes far beyond ordinary parlance. In other words, this doesn't sound like normal speech. Brown says, all recognize that the absolute ego a me, okay, with no predicate, has a special revelatory function in John. And I would agree. My personal view is that the absolute instances, when ego a me is not qualified at all, it's just I am. I really do think those go back, or I should say, I really do think those are specifically designed to link Jesus with God. And again, we're not yet at the part of the question, like, what's the point of origin? Is it the burning bush or something else? And I'll tell you what the something else is in a moment. But I think those are the most compelling ones. And this is where Brown is tracking here. So let's go to his second way that we find ego a me used in John. He says, the use where a predicate may be understood even though it is not expressed. So from the context, he says, sometimes you can infer a predication. John 6:20, the disciples in the boat are frightened because they see someone coming to them on the water. Jesus assures them, ego a me, I am. Do not be afraid. Here the expression may simply mean, hey, it's me. It is I. Someone who you know. And not a supernatural being or a ghost. You know, don't freak out. Okay. And Brown says, we shall point out, however, that divine theophanies in the Old Testament often have this formula, do not be afraid. I am the God of your ancestors. So John 6:20 may have John, you know, giving us, his readers, an epiphany scene, and thus playing on the ordinary and sacral use of ego a me, and playing on these Old Testament instances. Now, if that's the case, this is me talking now. If that's the case, Brown is saying, well, John 6:20 might have come from somewhere else other than Exodus 3. Might have come from one of these other theophany scenes. But again, we're still not at the question of where does this come from. He also brings up in this category, again, this inferred predication, John 18:5. The soldiers and police who have come to the garden scene, or the garden, across the Kidron to arrest Jesus, announce that they are seeking Jesus, and Jesus answered, ego a me. This means, I am he. But the fact that those who hear it fall to the ground when he answers suggests a form of theophany which leaves men prostrate in fear before God. Once again, John seems to be playing on a twofold use of ego a me. Again, I would agree with this as well. I think John 18:5 is one of these instances that equate Jesus with God. But again, we're still not at the question of where does it come from. So those are the first two categories that Brown says. Now, third, you also see this in the Gospel of John. Third, ego a me used with a predicate nominative. In seven instances, Jesus speaks of himself figuratively. I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. Okay. Well, John 6:35, John 8:12, I'm the light of the world. John 10:7-9, I am the sheep gate. John 10:11-14, I am the model shepherd. John 11:25, I am the resurrection and the life. John 14:6, I am the way, the truth, and the life. John 15:1-5, I am the real, I am the vine. Okay. Brown says, that's just a taste of what there is, what's going on here. So you can see in that third category, use with a predicate nominative, it's qualified. It's accompanied. Ego a me is accompanied by another word that defines it, or that says something about I, you know, the speaker, the subject. And that is not what you have in Exodus 3 or in this other thing that I'm going to introduce you to in a moment. So at least those, there's no coherent way to say those go back to Exodus 3, the burning bush. The other two categories, I think really the first one, ego a me with no predication. Again, that's the strongest link, I think, between Jesus and God. But category number two, ego a me with sort of a contextually suggested predicate, that can work too. The third category, I mean, I don't see that, because, you know, I'm the resurrection and the life. Okay, well, okay, God is the source of life. We know that, but maybe God is just using this agent to affect life. In other words, it doesn't have to be a necessary equation. I'm the good shepherd. Well, you know, again, it's not a clear path back to an equation with God. I realize you can do like sermonic things. You know, you can sort of get there in a roundabout way. I understand that, but the first two categories of the three are just, it's more secure footing that's consistent sort of with the grammar and the grammar in context. Now let's move on to the second question, the possible source. Now it's true. It could be Exodus 3. It could be the burning bush incident, because it's true that in the Septuagint, Exodus 3:14 reads as ego eimi in the Septuagint. It's Greek. But the reason I and others are hesitant to say, bingo, that's it, is because a really good argument can be made that ego eimi in the Septuagint is used of something else that makes the same theological point. It is often used to translate a statement in Yahweh's mouth in the Hebrew Bible, and that is, ani hu, I am he. And it's actually a really important statement. I'm going to read you a few of these. Deuteronomy 32, 39. See now that I, even I, am he, and there is no God beside me. I kill and I make alive. I wound and I heal, so on and so forth. Isaiah 41, 4. Who has performed and done this, calling the generations from the beginning? I, Yahweh, the first and with the last, ani hu, I am he. Isaiah 43:10, you are my witnesses, declares the Lord, and my servant whom I have chosen, that you may know and believe me and understand that ani hu, that I am he. Before me, no God was formed. Okay? Isaiah 43:13, also henceforth, I am he. There is none who can deliver from my hand. Isaiah 46:4, even to your old age, I am he. Isaiah 48:12, listen to me, O Jacob and Israel, whom I called, ani hu, I am he, I am the first, and I am the last. Isaiah 52:6, therefore my people shall know my name, therefore in that day they shall know that it is I who speak, ani hu, I am he. You know, you have, ani is I, it's the personal pronoun, first person pronoun in Hebrew. You also have an alternative, anoki. You have that too, anoki hu. Instead of ani hu, you have anoki hu. Isaiah 43:25. I am he who blots out your transgressions for my own sake and will not remember your sins. Isaiah 51:12. I am he who comforts you. You know, who are you that you are afraid of man who dies, and the son of man who is made like grass? So this, you know, all these examples of ani hu or anoki hu in the Hebrew Bible, most of them in the Septuagint are ego eimi. And so you could actually have John's ego eimi statements going back to that. So you got a choice. It's either Exodus 3 or it's these instances of ani hu or anoki hu. Most of them are in the servant portion of Isaiah 40 through 55. There's a couple in Deuteronomy, or at least one in Deuteronomy. So which is it? And the answer is, who knows? It could be either. It could be both. So it's not a clear-cut thing, even though you'll hear this from the pulpit a lot, that ego eimi in John, you'll hear two things that are, one of them is clearly mistaken, that all instances of ego eimi equate Jesus with God. That is not the case. You know, we read seven or eight of them that are qualified that don't really answer that question. But you have a number of them that I think certainly do, and I'm not alone here. A lot of scholars would say, yep, this is what John's doing. It's blunt, especially the non-predicated ones. They sound odd because they want to draw attention to this point, to this theological point of equating Jesus with God, with the Father. So, you know, it's not correct to say all of them do this. I'd say a good number of them do. And secondly, it's also not certain that it goes back to the burning bush episode. It might, but it also might go back to this other statement, I am he, ani hu, or anoki hu, most of them again are in the servant songs of Isaiah, and then one in Deuteronomy. So who knows? The theology is the same. It's just, you know, it's a little more complicated than what you might think or what you might hear.
All right, Mike. Well, that's all the questions we have this time. That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's it.
It was a lot again. I mean, they're good questions. These are not like Bible trivia questions. These are good questions.
Absolutely. They are good questions. All right, Mike. Well, we're going to have another Q&A, Exodus Q&A after this. Then we've got some interviews coming up shortly after that in March. So be looking forward to that. And with that, I want to thank everybody for sending in their questions, and thank you, Mike, for answering them, and everybody else for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.